Welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today's program takes us to Colby College in Waterville. We'll hear a recent speech by Dr. Mark Braverman, anti-tobacco activist. He is introduced by his daughter, Blair Braverman.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming tonight. My name is Blair Braverman, and I'm very happy to introduce my father, Mark Braverman, who has been an anti-tobacco researcher since before I was born. I'm very interested to see this because when I was a kid, he used to tell me about big tobacco, and it was like the boogeyman. I used to think it was going to come get me if I didn't lock my door and steal my stuffed animals. So now I'm going to get to hear about the real thing. Here's Mark Braverman.
Thank you. I don't remember making up those stories, but I wouldn't put it past me, knowing me. Okay, so I'm going to talk today about various issues relating to tobacco prevention and tobacco control in the two countries in which I have experience with it, which is in the United States and Norway. And I guess everybody knows what this photo is, right? First I had the Golden Gate Bridge up there, but then I decided, why not be local? So I found a picture of Mount Katahdin, and so that is a picture of Norway. So what I will cover today is, first of all, we'll take a look, an overview of tobacco and its effect on health, a brief review of some historical highlights relating to how we get to where we are today in terms of the social status of tobacco, a little bit about understanding and predicting tobacco use, in other words, why kids start smoking, some issues relating to tobacco control in the United States and Norway, and then finally, the World Health Organization's Global Tobacco Control Treaty, which is a very interesting and exciting development of this past decade. So I'll start by just saying a little bit about myself. I got my graduate training, my doctoral training at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Hey, oh, good. Okay. Yeah. Go Badgers. And so our mascot is the Badger. And it's important. The educational psychology part is important, as I was saying to people at dinner, because I came into the tobacco prevention concept through really kind of like classroom education or group education of kids. And that, to some degree, has kind of been left behind in terms of like a lot of the tobacco control approaches. And so I can talk a little bit about that too, but that's how I kind of got started in it. And so after I left Wisconsin, which was in the early 80s, I went to the University of California, Davis, and I was there for 22 years. And there I was a faculty member in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies. I was also the director of a little outfit we had called the Tobacco Control Evaluation Center, which was funded by the State Department of Health on tobacco tax money. And then I was also the director of a center called the 4-H Youth Development Center. And their mascot for many years, decades, was the Aggie, as is a few other campuses across the country. And people had kind of trouble with the Aggie as a mascot. We kind of knew what it was. It's somebody who works in agriculture, but it's hard to draw. And so probably around 10, 15 years ago, the administration decided that we should have a new mascot, so they made it the Mustang. But as you can see, they're a little confused because they have a picture of the Mustang, but they still say UC Davis Aggies. So they were a little confused about that. So therefore, I left. And 5 years ago, I went to Oregon State University, where I'm the an associate dean. I'm an administrator for outreach and extension in OSU's College of Health and Human Sciences. And I'm also a faculty in a department called Human Development and Family Sciences. And I'm happy to say that our mascot now is the beaver. So I am comfortable now having a mascot, which is a large, slightly dangerous rodent, which seems to agree with me. So that's where I am. And so then a bit about my work in Norway. I did a sabbatical there in the year 1998-99 in the Department of Public Health. It was not an academic position. It was really a public health agency position in the national, I should say, the National Institute of Public Health. And since then, also, I have ongoing research collaboration with a colleague at the University of Bergen, which is kind of like over a big mountain from Oslo, and his name is Dr. Leif Orda, and he's a great researcher in health psychology. So that's how I kind of come to this. And so I wanted to start off by talking about the situation of tobacco and health in the U.S. today. So how many people smoke? Probably, as of 2008, smokers in the adult population was about 20%. So about 1 in 5 people, more or less, smoke. And that's down from a high of about 45% in 1955, 55 years ago. So it's gone down quite a bit from then. But that 20% has been very hard. It's been very hard to move the needle on that. So probably it was about 24%, maybe about 5 years ago, and it kind of 1 year it's 19, the next year it'll be 20 again. So this is a bit of a hardcore statistic that it's very hard for us to control, despite all the advances that we're making in tobacco control. About 440 deaths per year in the U.S. are attributed to tobacco. That includes 400,000 from smoking and about 40,000 from secondhand smoke. These are estimates, of course. And probably in the mid-90s, I think it was, secondhand smoke was declared a carcinogen by the U.S. Public Health Service, and that's the number of attributable deaths to secondhand smoke that have been estimated. And that is a huge situation in terms of laws against protecting people in public places from other people's smoke. That's really the basis for clean air laws, and we'll talk about that as well. So it has been estimated that the percent of all U.S. deaths caused by smoking is about 20%, and that's an amazing figure if you think about it. One in five of the deaths in the United States are related to tobacco, somehow induced by tobacco. So it is indeed a huge issue. Okay, how about globally? We currently, the World Health Organization estimates that about 5 million deaths annually occur because of smoking. And let me stop here for a second and just kind of get a sense of the group here. How many of you would say that we're doing a really good job in terms of like getting a handle on tobacco control and reducing smoking as a threat to people's health worldwide? Just raise your hand if you think that's true. Oh, come on. Don't be shy. How many think it's not true? Okay, it's actually a complicated question. And I would say that most people think that we're making great strides in tobacco control. And in fact, we are. And that's part of what I'm talking about. But it's very easy for people to get overconfident and think, well, you know, tobacco has kind of been solved. We have all these new laws. Every couple of years, there's something new, great thing about control of the tobacco industry. But in fact, that's not true, especially when you look globally, because WHO estimates that 5 million deaths is going to increase to about 8 to 10 million deaths 20 years from now, in 2030, if current trends continue. And so if that happens, we're kind of on a slope upward in terms of the mortality threat posed by tobacco. Of course, there are a lot of things that are going on now, and we can try to interrupt those trend lines, and that's what people are working very hard to do. But this illustrates one of my themes, that the battle is definitely not won. A lot of people think, oh, tobacco's been solved. It's not true. In terms of where smoking rates are high, these are some of the countries in which they're the highest, especially in Asia. So China, Korea, Russia. Russia, as you know, is partly in Asia, partly in Europe. Those are all around 35 to 37%. Notice that in a lot of these countries, in a lot of Asian countries, there's an extreme difference in percent of men and women who smoke. Very high among men, very low among women. That's not the case in more developed countries. Those figures tend to be much more equal in more highly developed countries. Other countries that have high smoking rates, Argentina, 40%, the former Yugoslavia, the countries that make up the former Yugoslavia, probably around 47%. So you can see that's a lot of smoking going on. There's a lot of work for us to do at a global level. So let me also, just at this point, let's ask, how much is this a social justice issue in relation to just a health issue? So let's kind of look at some other statistics. And let's see how smoking rates may vary. Smoking rates among, this is in the United States, among people below the poverty line, about 1 in 3 people smoke. Among non-high school graduates, about 1 in 3 people smoke. College educated people, it's going to be you folks in a couple of years, less than 1 in 10 people smoke. People with a graduate degree, about 1 in 17, 6%. Physicians, 1%. So as you can see, smoking and the risk of tobacco is being now distributed across sectors of the population. It's relating to education, relating to income, and relating to poverty. So I would say it's very, very much a social justice issue because the people who are really threatened are people who are largely without resources. Another category, people with diagnosed mental illness. People diagnosed with schizophrenia, it's been estimated about 80% of them smoke. People with depression, about 50 to 60%. So the answer is yes, it's a huge social justice issue. Globally, total consumption of tobacco products is decreasing in many of the wealthier countries, as we were saying, but it is increasing globally. And more than 80% of the world's smokers, estimated at 1 billion, live in low and middle income countries. So that's where the industry is moving into. And the projection is by 20 years from now, 70% of deaths from smoking will be in developing countries. So once again, that's why it's on the social justice agenda. Let's talk a little bit about disease risks. That's not the main thing that I want to talk about, but I know that it gives us a basis for why we're talking about this to begin with. So let me just review this. I hope this will be a review for you. So we'll just talk about a couple of statistics here. Cigarette smoke has been analyzed to have over 4,000 separate chemicals. Now, that includes about 35 to 40 active known carcinogens. Among the ingredients in cigarette smoke includes carbon monoxide, ammonia, benzene, formaldehyde, and a lot of other ingredients that we usually don't want to put into our bodies. So that's in cigarette smoke. Diseases and conditions that are caused by smoking. I know this will be a review for you. First of all, lung cancer and other cancers, cardiovascular disease and stroke. These are just some of the main ones. Pulmonary disease, including emphysema, and wrinkles. And I put wrinkles up there. There's kind of a story behind that, because when I used to teach classes to like sixth graders, we'd go through some of these statistics. And we would say, smoking causes lung disease. And our sixth graders would go, yeah? And we'd say, yeah, and it causes heart disease and stroke and all kinds of diseases with your circulation. And you go, yeah? We say, yeah. And it causes pulmonary disease and all kinds of problems with your lungs. And they go, yeah? And we go, yeah. And it causes wrinkles. And they go, ew, wrinkles. So we knew we had hit a jackpot. And so that's why we always put it up there. But of course, there are other conditions as well. For people who, there's what percent of lifelong smokers will die from something relating to smoking? As a tobacco prevention researcher, I always have to answer the question of, I knew a guy who was 95 and smoked all his life, and he didn't die, and he was, if not perfectly healthy, at least he didn't die from smoking. And so it's a concept that's very hard to get across, that it increases your risk. It doesn't mean that every single person will die from this condition, but if 50% of the people die from it, that is huge. That is massive. And so that's something that we have to think about in terms of what is at risk, and we don't know who the people are going to be. And I will also say that even people, I would venture to guess that just about everybody who is a heavy smoker, a lifelong smoker, their health is impaired in some way, even if their life isn't shortened. And as I think everybody would know the answer to this, the addictive agent in tobacco is what? Nicotine. All right. So let me say just a couple of words about nicotine. Cigarettes are very interesting. Nicotine is the thing, the substance in tobacco that keeps you smoking. It's not the thing that will kill you. The thing that will kill you is those 4,000 separate chemicals. But nicotine is the thing that keeps you going back for the next pack. And it turns out the cigarette is very effective at delivering nicotine to your brain. The nicotine goes into the smoke, into your lungs, directly into your bloodstream, and from there to your brain. It takes about a matter of seconds, maybe 10 or 15 seconds, and people can feel the pharmacological effect of nicotine after they start smoking. So that's one of the things that cigarettes do. It releases neurotransmitters in your brain, among them dopamine, which is related to the reward centers of your brain. In other words, nicotine makes you feel good. And another reason that makes you feel good, in addition to stimulating dopamine, is that it also relieves anxiety and stress. Although in people who are regular addicted smokers, probably a lot of that relief of anxiety and stress is relief of withdrawal symptoms that they wouldn't be experiencing if they weren't smoking to begin with. So it does kind of like relieve that, kind of they get nervous and very jittery if they don't have a cigarette, and it does relieve that. So that's one of the ways that nicotine kind of acts. There are a lot of surveys of smokers, and a lot of times smokers are asked, if they want to quit. And about 70%, maybe 80% of smokers will say they want to quit, especially people who've been smoking for a while, who are like past the point of, let's say, image control for smoking. I mean, once they're into addicted smoking, about 70% of them want to quit. And do you know how many do quit each year? About 3%. So what does that mean? If so many of them want to and so few of them do, that gives you a clue about the addictive power. It is really extremely addictive. And I want to make one point that I think is very important. The vulnerability to nicotine addiction is very genetically variable. And so a lot of it is genetic. So what that means is that some people will find it a lot harder to quit than other people will. And it's not only a matter of willpower. If somebody has tried a couple of times and has not quit, it doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have enough stick-to-itiveness or whatever, they're not trying hard enough, they don't have enough willpower, it doesn't necessarily mean that. Of course, willpower has a lot to do with it. But for some people, they're genetically wired to be the addiction to be stronger. So a lot of that could be operating as well. So it's not right to really just blame people as a fault of their will if they're not able to quit. And then finally, very good news in terms of developments about tobacco is that there's a lot of things now to help people quit. There is nicotine replacement therapy. There are nicotine patches. There are other kinds of drugs that interfere with the action of nicotine, which make it easier to quit and kind of block the addiction. And then, of course, good old counseling is very good as well. Nicotine replacement therapy, I would mention, is people kind of wear a patch sometimes on their arm or other places, and it releases a certain amount of nicotine into the bloodstream. And so, of course, it relieves the withdrawal that people would feel otherwise. However, it does not give you kind of that big, quote-unquote, rush that you get from, like, taking a big drag on a cigarette, which, as I mentioned, can get to your brain in 10 seconds. That doesn't happen with a nicotine patch. And so that's why you'll find smokers, they may give up the patch after a while, because if they kind of miss whatever pharmacological effects they may be getting from cigarettes, it doesn't do that same thing. All it does is it works to relieve withdrawal. So that's kind of an interesting phenomenon as well. So, okay, let's move on from there. Tobacco control in the U.S., let's look at some critical events through history. First of all, in the 1870s through the 1920s or so, around that period of time was when the cigarette became popular. Before that, the forms of tobacco that people used were people smoked cigars. They used chewing tobacco. They used snuff, powdered snuff, which is a very old-fashioned product, which I imagine most people here have seen or may have a little familiarity with, and it's inhaled through the nose. It's actually not used much anymore, but it's still kind of around. So those were the main forms of tobacco. But then cigarettes started becoming much more popular. And the reasons for that had a lot to do with increased ability for manufacturing and distribution and sales. And also people were growing new varieties of tobacco. They were adding a lot of things into tobacco to be flavor enhancers. And so that was all part of the rise of the cigarette industry. And interestingly, I've also heard it said, and maybe I don't know if it's just a story, that one of the reasons that cigarettes became popular was, in fact, because of public health reasons. Because back when people used to chew a lot, they would spit a lot, and there were spittoons in every bar. And that would spread tuberculosis and other kinds of diseases relating to all kinds of icky diseases relating to people's spit. And so the cigarette was just smoked, and you didn't have to deal with people's spit hanging around. And so people thought it was healthier. So that's kind of ironic when you think about it. So that's around the period of time where it really became dominant. Then around the 1950s, it was really accumulating evidence that, smoking might be really, really bad for you. The first studies actually came out in the 1940s. But this is a British researcher named Richard Dahl. And he was one of the major names in the 50s that started doing these correlational studies. And they would find that they would look at, you know, lifelong smokers and lifelong non-smokers, and they would see that the lifelong smokers had really much higher rates of cancer and early death. And so he was just putting these things together. From a research point of view, those are not super strong studies. But on the other hand, they kept on showing up. And so he started publishing that, and people started getting worried about health relating to smoking's possible effect. So you know what the tobacco industry's response was? They were trying to be responsive because they wanted people to keep buying cigarettes. So you know what they did? That was where we first saw filters. They introduced filters. And you know what the early filters had in them? Asbestos. So try that on for size. Although now they have cotton. But I don't think they lasted with asbestos for too long. But so this is kind of a pattern with the industry. Just try to make people feel safe and, you know, just kind of keep people buying. So that is where people really started worrying about it. It didn't really take off until 1964. There was a U.S. Surgeon General's report about smoking and health. This is Luther Terry from the home state of Oregon. And he put out this report, and this basically said smoking will kill you. And what he had done is he convened a panel of experts, probably around 10 or 15 experts, and they met for a while, and they came out with these reports, and they tried to establish fairly conclusively that, yes, smoking does have this causative effect. And it's a little hard to imagine now, but it had a very, very powerful effect. I was kind of a kid then, but I remember, for some reason, everybody was talking about this report. It really grabbed hold of the American imagination. And that year, for the first time, probably in, you know, in anybody's memory, smoking started going down. And that was when smoking rates were still very high, probably around in the 30s or 40% of the population, but they started going down at that time. Okay, in 1971, television advertising ended. And the way that that happened was kind of an interesting story. There used to be a ton of ads on TV for all kinds of cigarettes. And a medical group sued the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, to put anti-tobacco messages on the air. And they used a legal regulation called the Fairness Doctrine to do that. And what the Fairness Doctrine said is that if there's a message that goes on TV or on the airwaves that says one thing, and there is an opposite position, you need to networks need to put that opposite position on there. So they started suing to put all these anti-tobacco ads on it. And so the industry became very worried about that, actually, and they kind of went in. The suit was successful, and they went into negotiations. And finally, the industry said, okay, we're going to stop advertising, and so no more anti-smoking ads, and then we won't put any more ads on TV either. And so just like that, television advertising stopped. But advertising money went right into print, and in fact, advertising budgets continued to increase. In 1988, California passed a tax on cigarettes. It was a 25-cent tax on cigarettes per pack. Doesn't seem that big now, but it created a lot of money and created all kinds of programs that California was able to do, including they started a major research program. They had all kinds of community education programs. They had public airway kind of commercials that they started using. And they started a very inclusive kind of program. And a lot of my work was actually funded out of the tobacco tax in California. So other states do the same thing, and I think most states have some kind of tax now. But California was one of the first and has been one of the most successful. Okay, in 1998, there was something called the Master Settlement Agreement. It was a very big development, and that was basically also a negotiated settlement. And the way that started, these are the heads of the major tobacco companies, and they were testifying before Congress a few years before that happened. And the way the Master Settlement Agreement happened was kind of interesting. A couple of states sued the tobacco, the major corporations, to get money back for the money that they spend in treating lung cancer patients and all the health costs that they have to provide because of people who are who have long-term conditions and are dying from smoking. And so they were suing for that money. And the industry became very kind of worried about that, and so they quickly negotiated that settlement. And so the suit never continued, and so they because of that, there was a whole range of things that were instituted because of that suit, including $209 billion went to the states over 25 years. And no advertising to youth, no more outdoor ads. They provided money for public education, and there was information about industry documents that they were that came to light that had been secret before. If you think of it, the industry agreed to pay $209 billion, and they were considered to get a good deal. A lot of people, analysts now, think that probably the industry got a good deal by that. A lot of people think those suits should have been allowed to continue, which might have bankrupted the industries. And one of the problems with the Master Settlement Agreement is that states now get a lot of tobacco money. If you ever read the newspaper about tobacco money, the states, in addition to other sources, a lot of it is MSA money. And as states become more and more broke, they depend on that money. And what that means is that states have a financial investment in the health of the tobacco industry. And so that's one of the other problems that we have with the MSA. And then finally, 2009, there was a law that was passed that gave the Food and Drug Administration the power to regulate tobacco as a drug. And that's kind of interesting. And that was actually something that was working for about 15 years. The FDA had wanted to do that for a long time. The industry had fought it. And then finally, the legislation came to pass. But it's being challenged in the courts, and it's going to wind its way probably to the Supreme Court. The FDA is trying to do a lot of things relating to tobacco. They're trying to put severe restrictions on advertising. They would like to, you know, restrict sales as much as they can. Interestingly enough, the law says that they cannot ban the sale of tobacco outright. In other words, they have to allow it to be sold to adults who presumably can decide for themselves. And also, they cannot require that nicotine be eliminated from cigarettes. So nicotine cannot go down to zero in cigarettes, but they have a lot of other regulatory power that they have. And one of the things they want to do is to force all advertising to be just text. They call that tombstone advertising. So all ads would just be no more pictures, just text. And the industry is fighting that very hard. And interestingly enough, it's becoming a free speech issue a First Amendment issue. There are some First Amendment analysts and lawyers think that, in fact, that kind of speech for advertising, which is commercial speech, cannot be restricted to that degree. And so it's an interesting fight that's going on, and I would advise you to pay attention to it as it goes on, because we'll see what goes on with that. Okay, let's look a little bit about why people might want to smoke. I'm going to go through this pretty quickly. I just actually wanted to provide one model. This is by a colleague of mine, Dr. Brian Flay, who has a theory that he calls the theory of triadic influence, which basically means there's a lot of different influences on why people smoke. So I put up this diagram, and part of the intent of this diagram is to be very complicated. So I want you to go, wow. I mean, who wants to like look through all that? But really, the other point is that it's recognized there's a lot of different reasons why any particular young person comes to using tobacco. And I want to point out a few things for you that, in particular, about this chart. One thing is knowledge and expectancies. So in other words, the idea is everybody who, actually you can say about any behavior that you do, but like if you haven't smoked a cigarette in your life and you're starting to smoke a cigarette, you have a set of expectancies about what's going to happen when you do it. You'll either enjoy the drug effect, or maybe you'll hate the drug effect, or maybe you'll fit into a social situation, or maybe you won't. There's a whole range of things that you think will happen, and those are the expectancies, and depending on what those are, that has a big influence on whether you start smoking. Another thing, this says here, values and evaluation. So in other words, what are the values that you place on each of those things that you think will happen to you? Moving on to what Brian calls the social situation, we have one thing is perceived norms, which is very big in terms of tobacco control. And what a norm is kind of like your theory about what is the expected thing to do. And if you can think about it with kids, you know, that's very important to kids, and it's very dominant in their thinking. So they think about what do I need to do? And when you think about what is expected of you, you're thinking about a lot of different audiences. So what do your parents expect you to do? What do your teachers expect you? What do your friends expect you to do? What does your younger brother expect you to do? What does your dog expect you to do? And all of those have certain levels of importance to you. So if you have certain things, it's a perceived norm. It may not be an actual norm. So if you think, for whatever reason, your friends will be more comfortable if you smoke, whatever, if that's very, very important to you, more important than what your parents will think, that enters into the equation. And I just think about it for a second. This goes beyond kind of a simplistic view of social pressure. It's really not about social pressure. It's not about, and I think we all know, you know, there was a time about 5 or 10 years where researchers were trying to get kids to resist social pressures. It's actually much more complicated than that. So it's not about somebody directly asking you to, you know, smoke and you saying, no, I don't want to, and knowing how to say no. I mean, that maybe a little bit of it. But more than that, it's your own theory about what are the things that are going to get me where I want to go. And it could be nobody says anything to you. But for one reason or another, these are the things that you expect. So these are all things that are in there. And as we'll see in a moment, advertising plays into that a lot. And then finally, his third area is biology and personality. And that has to do with different kinds of skills, et cetera. I won't go into details, but it's a kind of a whole different set of things. So strategies for tobacco control. These are strategies that have been found to be quite successful. I'll go through them rather quickly. One is taxes. Kids in particular are very sensitive to taxes. If you slap a tax on tobacco that makes cigarettes become more expensive, kids will be one of the populations that reacts most severely to that. As you can imagine, addicted smokers do not. They'll keep on buying cigarettes no matter what, which is actually one of the things that bothers me about taxes. Taxes are very effective, and I favor them, but it does worry me that there are like kind of these old veterans, these old sailors, who just keep on buying cigarettes no matter what, and it's taking a bigger and bigger chunk out of money, which they may not have. So that's kind of also kind of a social justice issue. The other thing about taxes on cigarettes is that, as we've seen from the earlier statistics, it's becoming in large part a tax on the poor that's heavily placed on poor people and poor families. And so it's a regressive tax. Because the people who are paying it are the people who have, in a way, the least resources to do so. So it's a little bit double-edged. But nevertheless, it is very effective in cutting down smoking. Clean air laws are major in terms of just making sure that people can't smoke in public places. And in fact, there was a report, kind of a secret report, that had been commissioned by the tobacco industry in 1978 by the Roper Organization. And that report came back and said that the biggest threat to the health of the tobacco industry is concerns about secondhand smoke. In other words, somebody else's smoke and what that'll do to you. And they said if the industry isn't able to somehow or other try to control that or get a handle on that, that could play a huge role in bringing the industry, I don't want to say bringing the industry down, but it could be a huge problem for the industry to handle. And that has turned out to be entirely true. That is one of the biggest weapons we have in terms of cutting down people smoking. When people started thinking that it's not just purely a matter of social choice, you do what you want to do, I do what I want to do, if people think that what you do can kill me, that created a lot of opportunities in terms of laws and in terms of what made sense in terms of doing laws. And so reducing secondhand smoke has been a major, major strategy. Restrictions on advertising, we've talked about that. And finally, restrictions on young people's access. So if you can stop people from being able to buy it, either restrict what kinds of stores it's sold at, make sure that they can't get buy it, et cetera, until they're of age, that's a major thing too. Okay. Let's look a little bit about advertising, and we'll see, kind of like go through a little bit of where ads were through the years. So this is like an ad from the 50s. If you remember, there was a lot of attention on doctors and what do doctors think in the 50s because of the emerging thoughts. And so the tobacco industry had a lot of ads about like what do doctors think. And so here was a doctor who was saying that Luckies are particularly good for one reason or another. Here's one that even talked about dentists, so I don't know why dentists would weigh in. Here's one from a former president, sending Chesterfields to all his friends. Somewhere along the line, the industry got a little smarter about advertising. And so if you notice, a lot of those previous ads were kind of text-heavy. They began to think they're not really selling text. You don't really have to convince people. They started working on more of a subconscious level, subliminal level, and they were just selling image. So this is what a more modern ad would look like. You would just see there's just no text in there at all. This warning has to be in there because there's a law that says that smoking is bad for your health, so that's not anything the industry wants to put in. So they just put the product in there and kind of an image about who people want to be. This gets back to the expectancies that we're talking about in terms of why kids start smoking. If they start identifying with these characters, then it can have a very powerful effect. So this is for Marlboro, but it's true for others as well. That one on the right for Newport, kind of like gets the adolescent angle in there a little bit. So it's all about where do I want to go, what do I want to be? And so again, you can look at the question, what are they selling? They're selling just these things. They're selling what people are going to think, your own image, your sense of yourself, et cetera. So it happens at a very kind of, I guess you could say, a very subconscious level. Finally, one more example, we'll look at Camel. This was an old-fashioned ad for Camel, probably from, I think there's a date up there. Oh, I think it says 1955. So look at all the text in there. Who wants to read that? Who wants to be convinced that Camel's the brand you should smoke? So eventually somebody got smart and they came up with, anybody can guess what comes next? Joe Camel. Again, not a whole lot of text in there. It's just like there are other ways to show you that you can be cool. And Joe Camel does a lot of different things. And he seems to be everywhere. But whatever it is, he's always really, really cool. And Joe Camel was probably, it was very big. He probably came on the scene around in the 90s or so. And it was eliminated as part of the Massa Settlement Agreement, that big negotiated settlement I told you about. And when they decided to stop advertising to kids, they eliminated all cartoon characters. And Joe Camel had been a real pain in the neck for the public health advocates. And he was kind of like public enemy number one. And so Joe Camel was finally retired. But I wanted to show you one other Joe Camel ad. We used to show this to our sixth graders. And I forget, actually, if we pointed this out to them. But the person who I used to present with had read somewhere, and she kind of swore that if you... So this is Joe. He's in a hot tub over the Hollywood Hills or, somewhere like that. And he's looking out over the city. And if you look in the lights of the city, it spells out the word sex. So you could take a look and see if you can see it. You can kind of see the X is, like, right around there. And then maybe this might be an E, this might be an X. So a lot of, I don't know, who knows? It's kind of there, it's kind of not there. But this is kind of the subliminal stuff that is going on. But one way or another, it was, the Joe Camel campaign was extremely successful. And whereas in the past, Camel had been the brand of like old sailors, now it became hugely popular with kids, second only to Marlboro at the time, before they banned it and stopped it. So it's an example of the way advertising works. And finally, I wanted to show you some things about counter-advertising, because this is very big as well now, too. I'll go through just a couple of these. You have counter ads that are general straight-ahead themes about people trying to convince people about smoking. You have parodies of cigarette brands. So Joe Chemo is pretty good. And this is kind of a well-known ad, I Miss My Long Bob. That's Marlboro Man. And then there's your standard kind of horrible gross-out ad, which I guess always has a place, I don't know. And then finally, you have kind of like your edgy Madison Avenue ad, which are these. So these have all been tried. And that fishhook ad, I should mention, was a campaign that was in England. And European countries and other countries, Australia too, for some reason, are much more bold in what they do in terms of counter-advertising in the United States. That kind of stuff would not happen in the United States. I think this one, the bottom one, was I think that might have been Australia, actually. NHS stands for National Health Service. So I will say one thing as we leave advertising is that there's a lot of these counter-ads. I mean, we saw a lot of the very kinds of differences in print ads. If this is at all an interest of yours, I think personally there's not nearly enough research being done on how these various kinds of ads, approaches to ads, are done, what makes an ad effective, how long they're remembered for, what kids think about them, what other people will think about them. So I just think it's a very, very fertile area for research, and we need more of it. And so if this is something that's interesting to you, it's something that I would really recommend. Okay, let's look briefly at Norway. I will take a few minutes here. So I guess I was going to start off with a travelogue, which maybe I will. This is a place in Norway which is a popular picnic spot. It's called the Preacher's Rock in southwestern Norway. And the thing that's funny about it is that, like, families go there a lot. It's really not that hard to get to, although, as you can see, it's pretty dramatic. And so people just go there and, like, hang out. They do picnics. And so we went there one time. And, you know, the adults would be sitting around eating stuff, and kids would be running around. There'd be dogs running around. And it would drive us crazy. It was really nerve-wracking. So something about Norwegians, they were very calm about it. Here's another view of it. And then finally, here's another rock. This is a place called the Lysefjord, and there's this strange rock that is kind of stuck between these two cliffs. And so I guess kids on occasion like to go in there and stand on it and get their pictures taken. So I don't know what that says about Norwegians, but they are a very kind of physically bold people. So anyway, so when we got to Norway, what was kind of interesting is that in 1998, so 12 years ago, there was really no appreciation among Norwegians, and this is probably true for Europeans in general, about secondhand smoke. There was already quite a movement going on in the United States that, you know, secondhand smoke is very, very bad for you. But people who were, like, very polite and very civically minded, they would just keep on smoking and not think anything of it. I think that's really changed now. It might have been related to their high smoking rates. I don't know, but that was something that we had to find out. So in restaurants, it was very tough. So guess where we had to go eat a lot? Any guesses? McDonald's. It was always smoke-free. So I really have to hand it to him. That was, I should say, it was before my family became vegetarian. So we would go there, and we'd be able to eat without having smoke. And so this doesn't look too much like tobacco control, but I will say that Norway has a history, a long Viking history. People would, like, travel across the ocean, and they would kill, and they would pillage, and they'd do anything they want. And so people were kind of wild and fearsome. And so, as you can see, they probably didn't like to follow rules too much. Here's a modern version of that. And yet, Norwegians are very favorable towards legislation. So it's kind of an odd thing, and much more than in the United States. And so they have always been on the leading edge of legislation for anti-smoking things. In 1975, they banned tobacco advertising with a couple of exceptions. They banned workplace smoking in 1988, way before most places in the United States. In 2004, about 6 years ago, they had a comprehensive ban on all smoking in all public places. That was part of what my research was about. And in 2005, they were the first country to ratify the World Health Organization's Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which we'll talk about in just a moment. And so they have a great, really, record of legislation. So what does that do for their smoking? Well, these are the Scandinavian countries. Again, around 1998, the percentage of daily smokers were about as follows. The kind of the stars were Finland at 18%, Sweden had 20%, Iceland had 24%. Denmark was kind of the wild boy of the group with like 37%. These are 37% of its population, of its adult population, were daily smokers. And Norway kind of came around the middle at 31%, which was not really what public health advocates in Norway wanted. Now I think the numbers have gone down a little bit, have gone down quite a bit. So that figure for Norway now is about 21%, kind of similar to the United States, although it doesn't include occasional smokers. Sweden is down also from 20, is down to about 17%. So Norway is catching up to Sweden. But for Sweden to be ahead of Norway in anything, it really makes Norwegians very unhappy. It's kind of like the Red Sox and the Yankees. It really bothers them. So I'm sure they'll be trying to work hard. So I wanted to say a bit about my own research. I won't go into it too deeply, but this was in a journal called Tobacco Control that came out in June of this year, 2010. And in particular, what I looked at was reactions to the comprehensive ban that was passed in 2004. And it's been very successful in lowering smoking rates, but it's also been very popular, fortunately. Bans, wherever they have been instituted, have been very popular. Here's a map of, this was a couple of years ago, but this is like where bans were in Europe. And it's important that they be popular in public opinion, because if they're not popular, then government does not have the courage to pass them. So there is a lot of work on seeing what people think about it. And so what this shows is that the red countries were the one, and again, this is around 2007, 2008. The red countries are the ones that had comprehensive bans. Ireland was actually the first one. That means in any pub, in any bar, no matter what, you can't smoke anywhere. So I think that's true for Maine now. It's true for a lot of places in the United States, but like around, even as early as like 6 years ago or 10 years ago, it was inconceivable to think that people wouldn't be able to smoke cigarettes in bars and pubs in Ireland and UK and England. Nevertheless, there it was. And England had a total comprehensive ban. So did Norway, a few other countries. The countries that are kind of the dark brown, they kind of banned smoking, but there were no smoking sections allowed. And then the lighter brown was you couldn't smoke in restaurants, but you could smoke in bars. And then the light yellow ones were you couldn't smoke in public places, but you could smoke in all restaurants and bars. And then the green ones, you could smoke anywhere. So the point is, this is not a bad map in terms of like these restrictions, and it's gotten even better in the last few years because France, Germany, Italy, all have comprehensive bans. And these are countries where tobacco is really ingrained into the national psyche. And so people can't smoke in, you know, kind of a coffee bar in the morning when they're having their espresso. They can't smoke when they're drinking at night. It's a major, major change. And guess what? People like it. Even smokers like it. So it's a very odd thing. So what we did in our research, we tried to look at that in a little more detail. And I'll just give you a couple of highlights from here. We did a survey. I was just analyzing the data set. A bunch of Norwegian researchers actually did the survey. But they were surveying bar and restaurant workers. So people who worked in bars and in restaurants to see what they thought of it. And if those people were favorable toward the ban, then that would be really good because bars and restaurants are one of the real cutting points in terms of trying to make this legislation happen. So where it says attitude factor here, these are the three kind of surveys that were done. And we basically said that we were looking at the things that would influence what people would think of the ban. So we figured it would be things like education, gender, age group. All of these things are influences, whether they work in a bar or a restaurant, and whether they're smokers. Again, even if you're a smoker, smokers approved of the ban too. Before the ban started, they had a certain level of approval. And then after the ban was instituted, even smokers like it more. It's kind of a strange thing. And so we, however, looked at patterns of individuals, and the scale on the right there, as you can see, that for every demographic category, you can see pretty much the lines go up. On the other hand, if you look at individuals, it's all over the map. So what we found, which was, we thought, interesting, is that we were able to explain that variation on the basis of only two things, in addition to all the other demographics, and that was whether their smoking status changed and whether they were afraid for losing their job, because don't forget, they worked in a restaurant or a bar. And so we were able to track individual cases. And so, for example, if you look at this case here, case two, this is a female who's between 35 and 44, lower secondary education, which is approximately the same as junior high school education. This is what her group was predicted for. You see, across the three points in time, her attitude is predicted to go up. But at time two, so she started off being a non-smoker, and she wasn't worried about her job. At time two, she became a daily smoker. That probably means she had tried to quit and relapsed. And her support of the ban dropped like a rock. And then by time three, she had become a non-smoker again. Good for her. She tried to quit again. And she also, she was still worried about her job, but she was a non-smoker. And you can see she was catching up to her line. I'll look at one other case here. This guy here is a male between 35 and 44. He's university educated. And he started off being a daily smoker. And he also wasn't worried about his job. And you can see this line would predict, in terms of what we would expect, his support to go up. at time two, the middle of the ban period, he had become a non-smoker from being a daily smoker, and he still wasn't worried about his job. So his support went up huge. And then, unfortunately, at time three, he started smoking again, and he was worried about his job, so his support plummeted. So the thing that was interesting about this is a little bit esoteric, I realize, but the thing that's interesting about it is that we were able to predict at a very high level of predictability in terms of what people thought about it based on only those two things. So that was kind of an interesting thing in terms of discovering what people, how people respond to these bans. So just a moment, I wanted to say a word about the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. This is a worldwide treaty. It was adopted by the World Health Organization in 2003, and it entered into force. In other words, it became official in 2005. Countries had to start following it, which is a little complicated. And there are 168 parties to the treaty. There's only about 30 countries in the world that are not part of this treaty. One of them, unfortunately, is the United States. The United States has this thing about international treaties, and so it's been a very hard sell in the U.S. But it's really a great thing. It includes bans on tobacco advertising, regulating content of tobacco products, labeling of products, bans on smoking, like a bunch of stuff that you can see here. So it is very comprehensive. And the way that it works, you can imagine it would be kind of complicated. The way it starts off is that first they make this treaty available. The administration of countries, in other words, the equivalent of our presidential administration, could come and sign the treaty. And what that means is an intent to move forward with it. It doesn't really, you're not bound by the treaty before you do that. Then you have to go back to your legislative body. In our case, it would be Congress, and Congress has to pass laws in relation to joining the convention. The convention is a treaty. If they do that, then you become bound by it, and then you have to first start passing your laws. So if we say, yes, we accept the treaty, and we're going to be bound by it, then you have to start going through the debate about what's the ban on advertising going to look like, what does it have to do with the Constitution, how does it relate, what do we want to do about regulating tobacco content. So it's very complicated, and yet I would say it's probably the most hopeful thing going on now in terms of reversing these trends that we were talking about at the beginning of my talk. If this can work, it'll be a great thing. And its effectiveness will depend on how these countries implement it individually. So finally, just a couple of takeaway points. One is tobacco is a global social justice issue. It's not only health, but it has to do with social justice because it's more and more becoming a habit of poverty areas. There's been tremendous progress in public health actions, but at the same time, we know more than what we can do. And a lot of that has to do with political will, legislation, people opposing us, court cases, things like that. So we move slower than we would like to. The tobacco industry is very clever and very wealthy. And as you can see, they typically respond to a lot of these initiatives. They try to resist it, and then when it comes time that they can't resist it anymore, they jump on board and they change it in a way that's very favorable to them. They did that with the ban on television advertising. They did that with the massive settlement agreement. They're just very good at coming out the winner, even if it looks like they're being crushed. So that's a very interesting thing. And because of that, the story isn't finished yet. There's really no room for premature celebration. So those are my points, and thank you very much, and thank you for being a great audience.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today we heard a speech by Dr. Mark Braverman, anti-tobacco activist. This program will be available on our website, mpbn.net, and is available either on demand or as a podcast. Many past Speaking in Maine programs are there as well. That's at mpbn.net.